Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to be talking about something in everybody's interest, that is volcanoes. We all love volcanoes. And I'm here today with co-host Tom Gill from the Geological Sciences Department. And our guest today is Tom Casadevall from the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver. So, Tom, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Again, yes, indeed. You're a regular sometime co-host.
Pinch hitter.
Pinch hitter, that's great. Well, let's get some home runs today. So, Tom, this is Tom Casadevall. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into being a scientist? What were those driving forces when you were a young mite?
Well, that's a very good question, Keith. First of all, I grew up part of my life overseas in Argentina. My father worked down there when I was a teenager, and we would travel a lot around Argentina. And so I was interested in two things on the landscape. One were the indigenous people living in Argentina, and the other was the spectacular geology that was exposed, especially in Patagonia. Here in the United States, we lived in Delaware, Wilmington, Delaware, and being on the East Coast, there's not a lot there that attracts you immediately to geology. But having the chance to travel through the Andes and in Patagonia, I began to be interested in what are those rocks, why do they have those colors, and how do the people relate on the landscape? Why are the people living in such dry, dusty environments? So when I went to college, I went to Beloit College in Wisconsin in the late 60s. I started as an anthropology major, social anthropology. Late in my stay there, I took a geology class, and the geology class fascinated me. And I also happened to do very well. It was the first science that I happened to get good grades in. So the instructor encouraged me to stay on and take historical geology, mineralogy, petrology, hydrology, etc. And lo and behold, another year and a half later, I had a double major in anthropology and geology. In the early 1970s, I got very interested in mining. I worked in Colorado for a small mining company called Bear Creek Mining Company, exploring in the Colorado Rockies. And I got linked into a small gold mine near Silverton, Colorado. And so when I went back to graduate school, I attended grad school at Penn State. When I went back to graduate school, working in economic geology, it was sort of a natural fit for me to do my master's and my doctoral thesis work on the Sunnyside gold deposit near Silverton. And in the process of working, those of you who know Southwest Colorado, geologically, you know that there's a lot of volcanic rocks, young volcanic rocks there. We say young, we're talking 25 to 35 million years old, but for geologists, that's a pretty young rock. But I got interested in looking at these volcanic rocks that were of tertiary age, and I thought, you know, if I'm going to study old volcanic rocks, why don't I go to some active volcanoes to get a sense of how volcanoes work, how they form? And so I worked over in Italy in the 70s with a French group studying volcanic gases at the big Mount Etna eruption in the early 70s. I went to Central America and visited volcanoes, particularly in Guatemala, but also in Costa Rica, and then later in Mexico. And then I had a chance to go after graduate school for a year to teach in Quito, Ecuador.
All together, it sums up what makes geology so fun, because, you know, in chemistry, you've got these damn laboratories, right? And you've got to go in there. And you guys, you just go out and kick rocks anywhere you think is appropriate.
Sure.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Absolutely.
It's fascinating.
Before we get on to the volcanoes and as a volcanologist, what you do and what's of interest to you, just go back a little bit to what you call the indigenous people of the Patagonia region.
Right.
I know little. I've read Bruce Chatwin's book, I think Passage to Patagonia,
right,
where he traveled around and met lots of Welsh descendant sheep farmers. That's all I know about the indigenous population. Expand upon that a little bit.
Well, in Argentina, there's two sources of modern-day indigenous peoples. Unfortunately, almost none of them were originally indigenous to Argentina. In the mines in northern Argentina, all the way down to the capital, Buenos Aires, there are a lot of people who have come into Argentina from Bolivia. These are Quechua-speaking Indians, indigenous peoples from Bolivia, and also people from Paraguay, Guarani. And they provide a lot of the service support in modern-day Argentina, whether they work as miners or whether they work as domestic help in Buenos Aires. In Patagonia region, you have a lot of indigenous people from Chile, the Araucanian people, for example, who have come over, and they're the ones that work in the estancias or the big ranches that where they raise sheep and cattle in the central part of Argentina, what we call the Pampas. And also they staff the ranches right along the Chilean-Argentine border going down into Patagonia. And what I was interested in specifically was, why do people migrate? Why do people leave Bolivia or Paraguay to come down into northern Argentina and come into Buenos Aires? And, of course, the obvious initial reason is that there's a source of employment there. It's not too different from the situation we face here on the U.S.-Mexico border today. And so the motivation for those people, and then how they adapted culturally to the social setting in Argentina. Argentina today is fundamentally an amalgam, like we are here in the United States, but an amalgam of people from European and Eastern European cultures. And it's a very ethnically very homogeneous culture. Probably the last big wave of immigration was at the turn of the 19th, 20th century when the Italians came in. And, of course,
brought football with them.
They brought football with them, but they also brought the music. They brought the tango, or they developed the tango
right in
Buenos Aires. So there were a lot of these cultural elements that sort of fascinated me, and it was the reason that I was interested initially in social anthropology.
Do you do anything with social anthropology, Tom? Or your dust stuff? I mean, that comes from people.
Not per se, but there are a lot of stories about, why and how people adapt and survive and adapt to the environment that they live in, a lot of which is controlled by the geology.
Right.
And we probably have a lot to learn from that.
Okay, so Tom C. I'm going to abbreviate.
That's fine.
It's Tom G and Tom C. So Tom C., tell us a little bit about how you became then really a volcanologist. You've told us, you know, what led up to it, and it sounds like an incredibly ordered career.
Or if there was a specific incident or thing that really got you into your current line of work. I know you've been here in El Paso. You gave a talk about the impacts of volcanic ash and the hazards of volcanoes. And was there a particular thing that got you into studying, you know, the hazards that these volcanoes present to people?
Those are good questions. After graduate school, finishing graduate school at Penn State, I went and taught for a year. I worked for a year in Ecuador, in Quito, Ecuador. And I taught a course on economic geology in volcanic rocks and on geothermal resources. And while I was down there, there were several volcanic eruptions in Ecuador. And, of course, being interested in the topic, I went and participated in those eruption responses. While I was in Ecuador, I was offered a position with the U.S. Geological Survey in Hawaii. And in the late 70s, the only volcano activity we had with the U.S. government was the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. We did not have a volcano program, per se. In 78, I went to Hawaii. I was brought there to set up a gas geochemistry program. One of the manifestations of volcanic activity is our gas emissions. People see volcanoes, they see the steam, they see the gases coming out, they can smell the sulfur gases. And the U.S. Geological Survey wanted to have a quantifiable, robust program of volcanic gas studies.
So you mean to identify what the relative compositions were?
Exactly.
Isotope ratios maybe?
Exactly.
Even.
We did stable isotope chemistry on the gases. Of course, the gases that come from volcanoes, the major one is water vapor. The second major gas is carbon dioxide, and the third major gas is sulfur dioxide. Now, water and carbon dioxide are available abundantly in the atmosphere, and they're difficult to measure the volcanic contribution directly. But sulfur dioxide gas is a fairly unique gas to volcanoes. We have equipment.
And copper smelters, I might add.
And copper smelters, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And we have methods of measuring the sulfur dioxide. And so over a period of years, we began by measuring sulfur dioxide, and that with different ratioing techniques, we could start to quantifiably estimate the abundance of water and carbon dioxide coming out of volcanoes. There's a whole suite of trace gases as well, but for the most part, it's water vapor, carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide.
Are there any inert gases that come out of volcanoes?
Well, there's nitrogen is found in the volcanic gas mix. There's argon, but they're fairly rare.
Right.
They're fairly rare. In the spring of 1980, actually in late March of 1980, we had some earthquakes up near Portland, Oregon, at a volcano that we learned, or mountain we called Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens was a volcano that hadn't erupted since about 1840s. But the earthquake near the volcano was a signal that something was going on, that there was unrest near that volcano. So a small team of us from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory flew up in late March, flew up to Portland, and began to make a series of measurements of the seismic activity, the deformation, which is a study of the change of shape of a volcano. And a volcano will change shape as new magma comes up into the edifice. And also at this time, we started to see gas emissions from small fumaroles or gas vents on the flank of the volcano. So getting back to your specific question, what really was the trigger event? I would say up until that time, I could have gone into the mining industry, stayed in mineral economics, or gone with volcanoes. But once St. Helens hit the scene 30 years ago, it really made me a confirmed volcano geologist.
So in fact, you see, the traditional idea is that a volcano, you know, we all know the shape, and then there's this upwelling from a magma underneath, and sooner or later it will blow, it'll go quiescent, and then it'll start again. But this is an event that was in fact stimulated by a fault deformation, an earthquake, which presumably made therefore unstable subterranean passages for molten lava to begin the exit.
I would say yes and no. It's a chicken and egg process. We certainly had some large earthquakes. They were magnitude 4 earthquakes near the volcano. And the question is, did the earthquake happen and then allow passage of magma? Or did magma start to rise and need to break rock in order to get access to the surface and cause the earthquake? So it's a chicken and egg. Certainly, magma rise and earthquakes are pretty intimately related as a geologic process.
And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. This is Keith Pannell, Tom Gill, Tom Casadevall from the U.S. Geological Service. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Your coffee smells much better than mine.
I'll bet it tastes better, too.
Yeah, rub my nose in it. You know, we shouldn't be amazed we can tell subtle differences in odors because a new study reveals we can distinguish between an astonishing trillion scents. That blows our old assumptions away.
We've all been going by a 1920s study that said humans can only discern 10,000 scents. Compare that with our ability to discriminate up to 8 million colors, and it appeared our eyesight outshined our sense of smell.
In reality, scientists suspected the estimate of our olfactory capability was a bit low. We have about 400 smell receptors that work in concert to perceive smell.
Natural odors are mixtures of components at different ratios. For example, a rose's scent is a mixture of about 300 components.
In the new study, 128 different molecules were used, each a distinct smell. They were mixed so that each mixture contained various concentrations of 10 to 30 scents.
Each study participant was given 3 mixtures at a time, with 2 identical ones and the third being different. Each person smelled about 500 odorants.
What researchers observed is that for people to tell the difference between the vials, the mixtures had to differ by at least 49%. Or you could turn that around and say 2 vials could be 51% identical and people could still tell them apart.
That's impressive, and even more so when we extrapolate the numbers to find we can distinguish between at least 1 trillion scent combinations. Now, we can't identify a trillion scents, but that's still quite good.
Makes me wonder just how crazy amazing my dog's sense of smell is. We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Tom Gill, Tom Casadevall from the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver.
Now, why do some volcanoes seem to wreak more havoc than others? Volcanoes are, I think, often almost always going off somewhere in the world. A lot of them lead to, you know, very picturesque pictures that we see on the news, but unless they're right next to a major city, you know, not too much trouble. But then every so often, volcanoes erupt in a way that there's concern about they could change the climate, or this one in Iceland that happened recently shuts down air traffic. What causes some eruptions to be such a key master of havoc compared to the others?
Well, thank you, Tom. That's a very good question. Let me first say that if no people or built infrastructure were near an erupting volcano, they would be considered to be a spectacle of nature, and that when we think about what havoc comes from volcanic eruptions, it's usually because people live on or near active volcanoes. For example, we've recently seen the eruption in Indonesia, in central Java, of Merapi volcano. There are probably 100,000 people that live on the middle slopes and lower slopes of Merapi volcano. The scientists in Indonesia knew that there would be an eruption because they'd seen several weeks of precursory seismic activity and deformation of Merapi volcano. And so they issued an evacuation order for a particular sector that they felt was especially vulnerable. And about 15,000 people evacuated. There was indeed a massive eruption in late October, and it produced what we call a pyroclastic flow, a flow of hot gas and volcanic debris that came down and inundated the villages that had been evacuated. But more than 30 people living in one small village had refused to leave, and of course they were unfortunately the fatalities. So there's an example of a volcano, a rather small eruption, that wreaked havoc simply because there was so much built infrastructure in so many villages in that part of the volcano.
There's a question that comes up from that, though. Why is it then that people will find it appropriate to create a society in such an environment? Is there something about the deposits that make them particularly fertile after years, or is there some mineral deposit? What's the feature that attracts people like us to live on the side of a volcano?
Well, there's a couple things. I would say the first issue is one, again, of economic need. Many of the volcanoes, particularly in the tropics, when volcanoes erupt and produce volcanic ash, that introduces a lot of key nutrients into the soil. And so in a place like Indonesia or in a place like Hawaii, volcanic soils are particularly rich. And so there's an immediate economic imperative that brings people to volcanoes because they can grow crops with greatly increased yields. For example, in 1980, 81, 82, in the Pacific Northwest, in the aftermath of the Mount St. Helens eruption, there was a dramatic increase for several years in the production of fruit in places like the Wenatchee Valley because the small amount of ash from Mount St. Helens introduced enough natural fertilizer and nutrients to the soil that it led to a little burst in productivity.
So that's a clarifying point, because you get the molten lava that comes down upon which you will grow presumably nothing. And then you've got the ash, which will be the sort of the fertilization of other areas around.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But a second feature that attracts people to volcanoes is the same reason that people like to come and live in El Paso, in part because there are beautiful scenery, beautiful mountains. And in many volcanic areas, you have people that are living there because it offers a respite from the heat. If you're living down in the Javanese lowland, where it's very hot and humid, and you want some relief from the heat, you move up into the mountains. And virtually all the mountains on the island of Java are of volcanic origin. So you're attracted there because it's a cool, beautiful environment to live in. And then thirdly, there's a strong religious element, particularly in indigenous cultures. Many volcanoes, particularly those with eruptions in historic time, are treated as having a supernatural karma about them or charisma. And in many cultures, for example, in Hawaii, there's the goddess Madame Pele. And Madame Pele is intimately related to the volcanic activity at Kilauea Volcano. And in the Pacific Northwest, many of the Cascade volcanoes there, for indigenous people, activity at those volcanoes has a supernatural meaning.
Right. So there's all sorts of complex social reasons.
There's many, many reasons. But then Tom posed another part to his question on the havoc piece, and that had to do with the climate change aspect. Some eruptions are larger than other eruptions. Eruptions come in all different sizes. and the size is related to the energy of the eruption and the amount, the volume of magma that's available to erupt. And in volcanoes that erupt explosively, that magma can be fragmented and it can be injected high into the atmosphere, well into the stratosphere, as we say. And once material gets into the stratosphere, that fine volcanic dust can circulate around the globe, and it provides basically an umbrella or particle shield that will have some effect. And we've seen in big eruptions like Mount St. Helens of 1980, the El Chichon eruption in Mexico in 1982, Pinatubo in 1991 in the Philippines. After those big eruptions, we've seen measurable changes in climate, measurable changes in temperature for a few years.
And are they always the same change?
They usually are related to a chilling or a cooling effect during summer months. In other words, summer seasons for growing tend to be shortened, and it usually lasts for several years, as long as there's that particle umbrella well up in the stratosphere. And Tom Gill is a much more qualified person to talk about dust in the atmosphere than me, but from a volcanic perspective, that's a key piece. The third element that I'll say, and this will tie back the impact on the atmosphere with the impact on humans, is that increasingly humans like to move around the globe by flying. And when you get into an airplane and you're going to fly somewhere, typically that aircraft will rise to cruise altitude of 35 to 40,000 feet. And that's at the top of the troposphere or at the base of the stratosphere. And that happens to be where a lot of volcanic ash gets concentrated. And so volcanic ash can present a significant threat to the integrity or the safetiness of air operations.
Now, why can't the planes just see the volcanic cloud in front of them and avoid it? And how does the ash disrupt the flights? Does it just chew up the engine by abrasion, or is something else going on?
Well, that's a great question. If you're flying in an airplane between Portland and Seattle and you see an eruption of St. Helens, clearly the pilot will be able to look out the window and see there's an eruption column rising from this volcano that he knows or she knows very well is an active volcano. And that pillar or that eruption column rising from the top of the volcano is certainly something that a prudent pilot would act to avoid. And they can easily avoid it by flying upwind, flying into the wind and simply staying away from it. But if you're flying, say, for example, from Seattle to Tokyo, that great circle route will take you over the volcanoes of the Aleutian Arc, which are in the state of Alaska up in the northern Pacific. And you could be hundreds to thousands of kilometers from that volcano. You could be flying at night. You could be flying with cloudy conditions. And so in many cases, pilots simply don't know. If they haven't been given a warning that a volcano has erupted, they simply might not know that a volcano has erupted, and they could inadvertently fly into the ash cloud.
But if you go back to this incident with this volcano in Iceland, and I'm going to have great delight in listening to the name in a moment. I mean, they had a very well sort of documented passage. They could see how the dust was moving, but I never read anything about altitude. And I'm just wondering, you know, the concept of just going higher, because a lot of disruption happened in
Absolutely.
That air traffic disruption.
Yep.
Or even going lower, flying underneath the cloud Sure. if it's at a certain height.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about the incident in Iceland that happened in mid-April of 2010. There was a volcano on the southern edge of the island of Iceland. And Iceland, of course, is in the North Atlantic Ocean. This volcano was called Eyjafjallajökull, or amongst the geology community, we just call it Eyja. But Eyjafjallajökull became active after a series of earthquakes in March of 2010. In late March of 2010, a small fissure eruption started to produce a very fluid lava of basalt composition, very similar to what you would get, for example, in Hawaii at Kilauea Volcano. The volcanic activity attracted a lot of tourists to the Eyjafjallajökull area, and it was a beautiful thing for tourists to view. As the fissure, or the crack in the ground that was feeding that lava, began to migrate up the slope, the fissure encountered glacier ice, snow, and a lake of melted glacier water at the base of the glacier. And suddenly the explosivity or the explosive nature of the eruption changed from one of fluid lava to activity that was very explosive. And on April 14th, a very explosive phase began that lasted for about 72 hours that fragmented, highly fragmented the magma and produced what we call volcanic ash. That volcanic ash was injected high up into the atmosphere up to about 35,000 feet altitude, which is just about the cruise altitude of aircraft flying between Europe and North America on the North Atlantic air routes. The winds at that time were coming out of the northwest, and they were moving the ash away from the volcano, carrying it just like a weather system cloud, and carrying it towards Scandinavia and the British Isles. And over a period of several days, we began to get reports that ash was falling in the British Isles and in Scandinavia. At the same time, meteorologists in London were making what we call numerical forecast models or trajectory forecast models to prognosticate or forecast where the ash cloud was going to move. And so those forecasts showed that the cloud was soon going to arrive over the British Isles, Scandinavia, and Northern Europe, Germany, Holland, Belgium, and Northern France. So the managers of the airspace in Europe, something was called Eurocontrol, they began to realize that if this volcanic ash was to contaminate the airspace over Northern Europe and the British Isles, that they would have to take precautions to start rerouting aircraft. The two types of damage that we're concerned about, one is it can reduce visibility, and if there is significant ash concentration in the atmosphere where the aircraft is flying, that the engines on a modern jet aircraft, the high bypass engines, ingest enormous volumes of air. And if that air's got some ash particles in it, those ash particles are very hard pieces of rock. We've been using the term volcanic ash, but volcanic ash is really just ground up rock fragments, very hard, very gritty, very hard, very abrasive. And as Tom alluded, one of the initial damages you'll get is abrasion or abrasion of engine parts, abrasion of the exterior of the aircraft. You'll get frosting of the windscreen, so the pilot's forward visibility is reduced. And then as that ash moves into the hot section or the combustor section of the jet engine, those engines operate at a sufficiently high enough temperature where they can melt the ash. And that melted ash can accumulate in the turbine. There's no ability to flow the air through the turbine. Air gets blocked. The engine shut off.
Has that happened?
Yes, it has. And okay. Over the last 40 years, we've had more than 130 incidents involving encounters between jet-powered aircraft and ash clouds. And about 30 of those have involved incidents in which the aircraft have lost one or more power to one or more engines. Now, fortunately, we've never had a crash because the pilots have been skillful enough to get the engines restarted. But the critical piece has been that ash can melt in the engines. That melted ash can accumulate in the turbines. When it blocks the airflow through the turbines close down.
Anyway, you've listened to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We had Tom Gill here. Thank you very much, Tom Gill, for sitting in as co-host.
Great to be here, Keith.
And then Tom Casadevall from the United States Geological Survey, Denver, expert volcanologist. I guess they're all experts if they're volcanologists. But anyway, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Keith.
And let's thank Norma Martinez, as usual, for putting it together, making us sound as good as we can anyway. And we'll see you next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.